Okay, let's get started. I'm Al Hegberg. I'm a senior fellow at the CSIS Energy Program, and with Bob and Lisa and Sonia, we're pleased to welcome you to this presentation by Jonathan Stern, who is a well and favorably known, as they say in the diplomatic trade, as an old friend of long standing of many people in this room, and a new friend of others, I hope. Jonathan is here on a quick visit and has graciously agreed to talk about Russia and gas in his new book. He has an ability to be timely, if nothing else, and it's really wonderful to welcome him here and welcome him back to CSIS, which he said he was last here about years ago, during the time of the coal era, I think it was. But anyway, we're not going to go around the room today, just given the size of the crowd, but it is his presentation is on the record. It's for attribution. An abridged form of the presentation will be posted on the website. So for all of you who are going to be writing away like crazy, you can actually read it on your own later. Anyway, Jonathan, it's a pleasure to welcome you, and the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Alice. That's very nice of you. It's great to be here, and great to see that at least some of the people that I knew in Washington all those years ago are still here. two short slides of advertisement, which I'm not going to go through. It's just that I don't think too many of us from the Institute have been in Washington recently. So we are still around in Oxford, and the gas program is one of the really active parts. And please go and visit our website. A lot of stuff there that's free to download, and the rest of it is available at bookshop prices, including my book. I know a lot of people here know a tremendous amount about this subject, and I am really going to whistle through what I call the agenda, so much so that, in fact, I'm hardly going to speak about the demand side, although it's a fascinating and difficult topic, and I'm not going to talk about internal reform and restructuring. In the Q&A, I am happy to talk about anything to do with Russian gas and Gazprom that anybody wants to talk about. But I'm really going to concentrate on the supply side and the international side, because that tends to be what most of the audiences are interested in. A map that will be familiar to very many of you, which shows where this industry is concentrated. I'm just going to do a little tiny bit, very briefly, of pointing out the three major fields that have sustained this industry over the last 20, 25 years. And the reason I'm going to do that is because I want to draw a fairly sharp distinction between those existing and operating fields and the new fields that I'm going to talk about in a moment. Now, again, I think a trend that's familiar to many of you, if you take a look at the last few years, what you see is a slowing down of the spurt of growth, which started again in 2000. And there are a number of significant reasons for that. Just before I leave this slide, I'm going to point out that the so-called independents, which I divide into oil companies and gas independents, those guys are, if anything, growing and I think have the potential to grow very rapidly. But if you take a look at the trend here, you will see that Gazprom's production is going to grow barely by 1% this year. Independents will do better. So what we are looking at is a further peaking of Gazprom's production and a slow decline followed possibly by a more rapid decline. And that's really because the three fields that I quickly pointed out to you are declining now relatively rapidly. And Zapoljarny, which is the new field that came on in 2000, reached its peak last year, and that it was, of course, offsetting the decline and more of those existing fields. But now the new satellite fields are relatively small, and so what we are waiting for is a decision as to whether, and if so, when, Gazprom are going into the Yamal fields. And I'll come back to the Yamal fields in just a moment, but on this slide I just wanted to note that you're looking at phases of Yamal development. I put $15 to $20 billion per phase here. This is a good argument for saying the real figure is more like $20 to $25 billion now. And I'll come back towards the end talk about Eastern Siberia and the Far East, but for me, Eastern Siberia and the Far East are another country as far as gas is concerned in Russia, and so I don't want to confuse the two things. This is perhaps the crucial slide on supply. This stuff is all in the book in quite significant detail. And essentially what I'm saying is that over the next 15 years, Gazprom will lose about 200 BCM, that's 20 billion cubic feet a day, of production because of natural decline. And this is just a continuation. For any other country, this would be a complete disaster. However, the resource base is already established to replace this production. The question is, how quickly will they do it? How much will it cost? And when are they going to do it? And that, of course, depends on this area here, the Yamal Peninsula and the Obtaz Bay fields. Now, for me, it's very important to make a distinction, which I will do on the map, between Bovinenko, Kharasove, and Kruzenstern over here, which are the supergiant fields, the Tasiskoy Tumbe group, which are big, but we're not sure how big they are. There's a bunch of smaller fields on shore down here. And then the group of fields that I'm quite excited by and Gazprom is increasingly talking about, which are the Obtaz Bay fields down here, which are relatively small. In anyone else's language, they'd be very big. But they are very useful fields because they are in fairly shallow water and they are close to existing transportation. And what that means is that if you try and plot when those fields could be on stream, you see a possibility of Obtaz Bay being in significant production by the early 2010s. I'm not saying they will be in significant production, but they could be. Whereas the Yamal Peninsula fields, you're really looking at something like 2013, 2014, before you see the first 100 BCM of production from those fields. And that's if they start next year, which frankly they're showing no signs of doing. So the key question is whether they're going to move ahead with the Yamal and Obtaz Bay fields in time to make up for the significant decline that's coming from the existing fields. And at the present time, my answer would be probably not. However, that again, despite what you read in all these commentaries, is not necessarily a disaster. And in fact, what I'm going to suggest later on is that it may be absolutely the right decision by Gazprom. And what we have is a bunch of other companies, essentially the four integrated oil companies, plus the two gas independents. I'm unclear whether I should continue to include Iterra in this picture. I do continue to include them because they are still a significant player in independent gas production. But essentially, the four independent oils, you know, at a time of oil prices where they are, these guys have got a complex agenda. They've got many investment opportunities. They could afford to wait for their gas. But the rising star in the gas firmament in Russia is clearly Novatek. Novatek, very, very interesting company. Production going to increase very quickly. Very competent management, good relationship with Gazprom, and a company that really bears watching. Of course, none of these guys can survive without Gazprom patronage. They also require some favorable regulation on transportation tariffs and favorable taxation. But what's interesting for me about these companies is that I'm not suggesting that this picture actually reflects what will happen over the next 10 years. All I'm saying is that these guys have the reserves and the financial capacity to put on up to 200 BCM by 2015. These guys have a lot of gas, and they can command money to bring it on. So it's a very significant potential source, and if Gazprom chooses to encourage it, we might see some quite significant gains here. In order for that to happen, Gazprom would need to be friendly towards these guys in terms of transportation. And again, transportation and the obstacles to transportation, sort of a presentation in themselves, all kinds of issues around processing capacity. Although I'll just draw your attention to the fact that last year, Novatek opened up a new processing plant, first independent to build a processing plant in Siberia. Very interesting move. I mean, I've put all the bottlenecks there on the slide, which I guess you can't quite see because it's going off the bottom. But essentially, it's all the problems that you face in a partly liberalized transportation network when the dominant player can decide that they want to block your gas or can allow you to do it. It's at a very early stage, but for those of you who are familiar with continental Europe, you will see many parallels between the stage of liberalization in Russia and in many continental European countries. But I wanted to just put up this slide because it seems to me there's a tremendous amount of skepticism about the amount of third-party access in the Russian system. I'm not suggesting that this is a tremendously exciting picture, but again, it's a picture that I think is surprising given where we were back in 1998. In other words, you've got gas being transported for the new players. The percentage is up to about 16% of total throughput, which again is not exciting, but compares pretty favorably to a lot of continental European countries and a lot of other countries elsewhere in the world that should be operating liberalized markets but aren't. So I'm not totally downcast by this, and I think there's a real opportunity because I see signs, and I'm not going to put it any stronger than this, but when I talk to the Gazprom marketing department, I see signs that the word is coming down from on high that actually transporting gas for other producers is not the worst thing that Gazprom could be doing. And, you know, when the dominant player starts to think like that, things can move faster than you believe. The other main source, of course, is Central Asia, and there's a whole presentation to be given on gas in Central Asia. I won't bother to read out all the stuff that's on this slide. What I wanted to say was that there is the opportunity for Gazprom and or CIS countries, and I'll come back to Ukraine a little later on, to easily be importing 100 BCM of Central Asian gas in the next decade. Now, clearly, there are other options for Central Asian gas supplies. I don't know how much credence we want to give to the Turkmen contract that was signed last week. You can think what you like about the pipeline to Pakistan and India, the Trans-Caspian pipeline. But, I mean, clearly, when you have an established network of lines which only need refurbishment, the costs are significantly lower than creating new greenfield pipeline capacity. The bottom line for me is that the way this network is currently configured, it would be easy for Central Asia to supply gas to Gazprom much more flexibly and at lower cost than either the Yamal fields or potentially some of the newer and more difficult Nadim Portas fields. Clearly for Gazprom there is a security issue there, and clearly for Central Asian countries there's an issue of creating competition for their gas between CIS countries and their other potential markets. There is also, for Gazprom, an issue of cost. Now, again, you could spend half an hour debating the assumptions on this slide, but despite what Gazprom says today, for regulated industrial prices in 2005... and perhaps in 2006, Nadim Portas gas, just in terms of operating costs, is profitable at that price. Arguably, they've slipped back a bit this year, just because of inflation and the fact that prices haven't gone up to match inflation. The cost base of the independents is much lower, and even with higher transportation costs, the independents are making significant money, even at today's regulated prices, never mind the actual prices they charge for certain types of customer at certain times of the year. Now, the big question is, what about Yamal Gas? And I've put on this slide the heroic statement that Yamal Gas delivered to Moscow would break even around $60 to $80 in 2005 dollars. That's a range that I still feel comfortable with. Some people have slightly lower numbers. Some people have much higher numbers. The problem being that Yamal is not a project. It's a series of options of fields, processing, transportation, markets. So that range is something that I feel comfortable with and can defend, but you could clearly find much higher costs depending on which of those options you were choosing. Now, here's the problem. Then today in 2006, with the Turkmen gas sales price at $65 a thousand on the Turkmen border, Turkmen gas in Moscow costs about $90. Now, clearly, $90 when you have a regulated industrial price in Moscow today of about 42, 43, a little bit more perhaps, that's not going to work. But nevertheless, the crucial point, which is missed by most of the commentary that I read on this subject, is that there is no point in Gazprom investing in Yamal, or indeed almost any new Russian supply, for as long as regulated Russian gas prices are where they are. And until and unless Gazprom sees the possibility that those prices will be allowed to rise significantly, in my view, it is not worth investing in large-scale new supply. I'll come back to that in a minute. I just wanted to stack all these options on top of each other, not to suggest that Gazprom and Russia could be using 1,000 billion cubic metres in 2015, but to indicate that there is plenty of potential supply. The problem is that the choices are very complex and they depend on costs and prices, most of which are unknown. And so the matrix of options that Gazprom faces are extremely complicated. And I've gone into this in some detail in the book, suggesting different combinations of supplies for different cost options and price options. And it really is an immensely complex picture. Because of time, I haven't used the slides on gas demand in Russia. The data I have, the data that are published, are extremely poor. We have no decent, worthwhile historical series for gas demand at all, let alone a temperature-corrected series. Most of the published data that are used are extremely approximate. Gazprom, to my knowledge, has three different sets of demand data for Russia, none of which are easy to match up on a historical basis. But the general points I wanted to make, a little bit more positive than those you might hear. They have made enormous progress since the disaster of 1998 to 2000. Regulated prices are now mostly profitable. Not for all customers in all regions, but mostly they are profitable. Payments are transformed compared to the disastrous days of 1998, and the government has some kind of commitment to raise prices to around $60 by 2010, although nobody quite knows what allowance in that is for inflation or for location. Now, $60 in 2005 dollars would allow some significant profits to be made, at least on a short-run marginal cost basis, and, as I indicated earlier, at the bottom end of the cost range for Yamal Gas. So they are approaching the ballpark, which I think is a whole lot more than can be said for where we were even a few years ago. But there's a lot to do. This is a slide which, again, substitutes for a long and highly complicated presentation on the whole question of demand and efficiency. I have, to some extent, changed my mind on this even since the book was published. Putting it very briefly, I seriously wonder now whether it is worth going on at great length about the potential for savings and efficiency given the current state of the Russian capital stock. In other words, as you very well know, if you visit a factory in Russia of any sort, you're very likely to be visiting a factory which was built no more recently than 1980. It might have been built in 1960, it might have been built pre-war. Now, I am uncertain how much savings and efficiency potential is worth having by spending money on that age of capital stock. I'm increasingly convinced that the key issue here is the replacement of capital stock and the whole question of confidence in property rights to enable that investment to take place. And large-scale replacement of capital stock is clearly a big Russian market reform issue, which is bigger than gas and bigger than energy. But with so much of the capital stock so old, for me, if Russia is going to be a successful economy in the future, there's got to be a massive turnover in capital stock. And if there isn't, I'm not sure that that is that really they can expect to have significant economic growth. But of course, when they do turn over the capital stock, the energy saving is going to be spectacular and enormous. And so that is, if you like, a big picture issue that we still have in front of us. Let me move on from the domestic side now and talk about exports. With Russia now exporting to 21 European countries, I've given up trying to get them all on a slide because nobody can read them anyway. Couple of points to make about this slide. Firstly, what you see is that virtually all the growth in the last decade has been in Western Europe. I'm sorry to have to use these Cold War terms, but it's easy because I know that you know the countries I'm talking about rather than having to put up the actual countries. You see that in Eastern Europe there's been almost no growth. In fact, there was a decline for many years, and the Baltic states the same. It looks as if there'll be about an export of 165, maybe a little more this year. But the growth in the last, well, since 2002, has been spectacular. The problem, of course, in this picture is this. It's the transit. And as you all know, most of the transit of Russian gas goes across Ukraine. There is the Yamal-Europe line across Belarus. There are one or two other lines, like the Blue Stream, which I'll come to in a second. And then on the top left-hand corner of that map, you'll see the North European pipeline coming in, and I'll come back to that as well. But before I do that, what I wanted to point out to you is I'm not going to go through the 2006 Russia-Ukraine crisis, although I'm very happy to talk about it. I gave a presentation at Columbia University yesterday on it, just a whole hour presentation just on the crisis. But I think where we are today with the two agreements in January and February is that we really have a huge number of unanswered questions about what will happen to the volumes and prices for the gas that Ukraine needs. The governance allegations against Rosukrenergo are serious and need resolving. The question of whether the Ukrainians should be required simply to take gas from Rosukrenergo or whether they should have their own right to negotiate directly with Central Asian countries, and particularly Turkmenistan. And unless this situation improves, and I'm not terribly optimistic, it seems to me that what Gazprom is looking at is simply minimizing transit via Ukraine to the maximum possible extent through other lines and building North European pipeline as quickly as possible. Before I go on there, what I just want to say is that what we're seeing here, I think, is a new era of Russian pricing of gas to CIS countries. And I've put some of the prices here. For me, the whole Belarus situation that blew up in the last couple of weeks is not particularly that the Russians intend to raise prices to Belarus up to European levels next year, but it's to say, look, 3 years of negotiating about Bell Transgas is enough. Are you going to give us 50% of the network? If you're not, tell us, and you're going to be paying European prices. So there's a new toughness, and there's a the piece today in the Washington Post makes the point about this is all about Russian tightness of gas. Well, it's something about that. But it's really about the opportunity cost now of supplying CIS countries against Europe when the gap is so great. And just to make just one point of detail, just to illustrate this, whether you believe that President Lukashenko is correct when he says the value of the Belarusian gas network is $5 billion and so Gazprom should pay $2.5 billion, or whether you believe that Gazprom is correct when it says it's $500 million and it should pay $250 million, whichever of those valuations you believe is correct, the subsidy this year at these Belarusian prices, I estimate at something like $3 billion US dollars. So that valuation would only take care of 1 year of the subsidy. So that's how much money we're talking about that's at stake here. So, again, question at the bottom about buying Central Asian gas, but I want to kind of hurry on a little bit because I've got quite a lot more to say and not too much time to do it in. What we're seeing in Europe is a new Gazprom selling spot gas in the UK, but also in Belgium. Just parenthetically, for those of you who are not so familiar with this, you know, it wasn't too many years ago that Gazprom was saying that, you know, they would never sell spot gas and long-term contracts were the only way to go. They have seamlessly moved into the gas trading business, hired a bunch of old hands from the European gas trading business and are trading away like crazy. I think, but I can't prove, that it's not just Russian gas they're trading either, which is smart. Essentially, what is happening, the two or three major things are happening is that, firstly, they're going to build the North European pipeline. They were going to do it even before this latest Ukrainian mishap, but now it's simply confirmed them of the rightness of that policy. And if I could just say that this pipeline, or I should say pipelines, but the first one, which should be around by 2010, this has really taken on a completely new notion as of the last 2 or 3 months. Because people, including to some extent me, were saying things like, well, why do you want to build this in 2010? I mean, there's no demand in Europe for this gas in 2010. But now the answer is, well, we're going to build in 2010 because it enables us to take 30 BCM out of the Ukrainian network and put it through the transit. And if they keep misbehaving, we'll build the next one a couple of years after that, and we'll have 55 BCM going taken out of the Ukrainian network. And so it is, for them, a security measure and a confidence-building measure for Europe. Now, supposing this first line is built by 2010, then I estimate that Russian export capacity to Europe will be around, something around 200, 210 BCM, depending on how quickly the Ukrainian network is deteriorating. But, of course, the other big story in Russian exports is diversification and LNG. And just before I leave this slide, I want to show you the little terminal at Ust-Luga, also known as the Baltic LNG terminal. We don't know if that's going to go ahead, but it's a nice little project, and it could be much earlier, because it's much more simple to go ahead, than the big Shtokmanovsky field and the terminal at Murmansk. Now, Gazprom is pressing on with this, and in the next couple of weeks, we should hear who the probably four favoured joint venture partners are, although I think we know the two Norwegian and the two American companies they're going to be. All I want to say about this is that it's like all those projects that people have said Gazprom probably shouldn't do this. They're going to do it. It's a beast of a project. It is just so complex in every phase, in every respect, and expensive that it's hugely daunting. I personally think Gazprom is now saying 2010, 2011, 2012. I personally think 2015 is absolute earliest, just because I think it's so difficult. But they're going to do it, and you guys are going to get Russian LNG here from Stockman. Very quick shift to the other side of the world. I have a whole presentation on Asia, which I don't have time to give. I'm just going to show about four slides of it. I want to show Sakhalin as a province. I want to show it as a province because we're used to knowing it as numbers, you know, Sakhalin 1, Sakhalin 2, up to 6, or if you think 7 or 8. This is a North Sea-sized gas province in which very few wells have been drilled. This province has the potential to supply East Asia with a huge quantity of gas for a very long time in the future. But that's not going to happen for quite a long time. And again, very complicated issues connected with each country that I could go into if people are interested, but I won't take the time now. This is currently where a lot of the action is in terms of the pipelines, which could find their way to a number of East Asian countries. The key for me is China and what the Chinese decide to do. And in my view, we are right at the beginning of this situation, and I've just taken a couple of slides on China to try and explain this. The whole history of the last few years have been the Chinese talking about building a whole lot of LNG terminals. For me, the last few months have demonstrated to them that they're not going to be able to do that because they're competing with the richest countries in the world for LNG, and they can't afford to do that in the way they can for oil. For gas, they can't afford to do that. There's a very good paper on our site, which is free to download, explaining the economics of this in terms of power generation. But the key question here, then, is that because of the way things are going in LNG, China is being forced towards pipeline gas, which, in my view, it demonstrably did not want to do, although, again, in my view, this makes absolute sense for them. You know, why are the Chinese insisting on competing with the richest countries in the world for LNG when they've got a huge source of stranded pipeline gas on their doorstep where they have no competitors? So they're being forced towards what I think is the right policy. What happened with the Putin visit? Well, they signed a whole bunch of curious documents. I personally think that the notion of taking a line from Western Siberia to join up with a second West-East pipeline makes no sense. However, I have learned that what I think makes no sense for the Chinese is not what they think makes no sense. So I thought it was crazy to build a West-East pipeline. The joint venture partners in the West-East pipeline said it's crazy. They went ahead and built it. They were told, you'll have to build another West-East pipeline. Don't build it. They went ahead and built it. Now they're having to build another one. So I don't think it's sensible for them to buy gas from Western Siberia, and I don't think it's sensible for the Russians to sell them gas from Western Siberia, but it may happen. Clearly, the eastern route from either Kvikta or Sakha, with probably Kvikta in the pole position, is the project that makes most sense. But I just warn you that, firstly, things that seem to people like us who live a long way away from Asia to make sense don't always happen. And secondly, in Asia, despite press talk of 2011, 2012, things take a long time. So, you know, I wish everybody luck. I think it could make a lot of sense. But if it didn't happen till 2020 or beyond, it wouldn't surprise me. So to sum all this up as quickly as I possibly can, Gazprom's basic problem is that it has this enormous agenda. Some of this stuff I haven't even talked about. I haven't talked really about reform. I haven't talked about network reliability, but that's a huge question. I've talked about supply replacement, imports, transit, European exports. I mean, the European export business of 160 BCM, 16 billion cubic feet a day, that's a big business to 21 countries. Then there are all these new projects, North European Pipeline, Stockman, Ust-Luga maybe, the Asian business. We didn't even mention the Sibneft purchase, just a, you know, a billion-barrel-a-day oil company. Now, can any management, however talented they are, can any management really handle all of this stuff simultaneously? I suggest to you, no. There's going to have to be prioritization. There's going to have to be selection. And the question is, how are they going to do that? Basically, Gazprom has a big incompatibility of agendas. Its strategic vision that you can read on its website of being a global vertically integrated energy company, I mean, it doesn't exist. There are no global vertically integrated energy companies. You know, people in Gazprom management talk about being, we want to be an ExxonMobil, we want to be a BP. ExxonMobil and BP aren't globally vertically integrated energy companies. So where's the business model? That worries me. But finally, I want to sort of finish with the theme of the book, which is the future of Russian gas and Gazprom, which contrasts it with the past. And for me, these are the things that are changing and will continue to change. This is no longer going to be a company at a country dependent solely on three major Russian gas fields. We're going to have a much more diversified supply. We're moving to a situation where Gazprom had a virtual monopoly of production. I think independents are going to have at least 20%, I would say more. Domestic market has always been loss-making, and we assume will be loss-making in the future. I don't think that's right. I think the domestic market is going to be at least modestly profitable in the future. It's been a past of exports to CIS and Europe. It's going to be a diversified future, although for me, LNG exports to Asia and North America on a large scale are longer term, as are pipelines to Asia. Gazprom, up until a few years ago, was really only interesting to European companies. I mean, it was a Russian gas utility with a few exports. For me, and this perhaps is the thing that really spurred me to write the book, today I don't think there's a single international energy company in the world that can say we're not interested in a relationship with Gazprom. Latin America, Asia, North America, anywhere in the world you see companies trying to form a relationship with Gazprom. And that is the big change that has happened and is going to shape the future. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jonathan, very much. For those of you who are interested in forming a joint venture with Gazprom, you have to get behind Jonathan. I'm going to ask Keith Smith to see if he has a couple of comments he would like to make, and then call on Bob to ask the first question.
Well, I don't really have a lot to add. I mean, this is pretty comprehensive. I just have some questions that I'd be interested in hearing from Mr. Stern about. One is a couple of questions. One, the Central Asians, will they continue to give Gazprom a monopoly of their shipments? How long can this last? And if it doesn't last more than a few more years, will that make it difficult for Gazprom to meet its commitments in Western Europe? The second thing has to do with European energy policy. After January 1st, obviously, there was a great deal of discussion about a European energy policy, and then there's been the Green Paper and all of this. Is there really a chance of a real European energy policy? And if so, what are the alternatives, if any, that Europe has for reducing its dependency on Russia? And that's assuming that it's important to reduce their dependency. I would say that keeping dependency on a certain level probably is something they'd want to do. But can they do it, and what are the alternatives? Does Europe really have a realistic alternative over, the next 10 years? That's all I would say, really.
I would like to. Okay.
Jonathan, my general take from your presentation is that you're reasonably confident that Russian gas can face a secure market, first in terms of supply and then in terms of demand for exports. But what if that doesn't come true? What if the supply doesn't develop as fast as hoped for? What if the pipelines are built, but there's not enough gas to put into them to meet the contract commitments that they've laid out for the next decade or two? What would Russia do then?
Okay, let me try and answer, because Bob, your question kind of goes sort of together with the first question that Keith asked. Most people in most commentaries make a direct connection between supply, Russian supply and Central Asian supply, and European gas contracts. There is no direct connection between those two things. Why? Because European exports are 160 BCM roughly today, And Russian gas demand, internal gas demand, is well over twice that. They have this enormous buffer of internal gas demand. And so my answer, Bob, is if I'm wrong and the supply doesn't work out and Central Asia doesn't work out, they will do what Russian, Soviet, and Russian people have done it for time immemorial. They will ration the domestic market. And they already know how they're going to do that. One of the things that it's very difficult is, I mean, I cannot get out of the Gazprom marketing people a decent set of demand statistics, but they've shown them to me, you know. They've held them up in front of me. So I know that they know who pays, who is profitable to serve, who could be shut down if they needed to be shut down, and how you would justify that if you had to justify it politically. You know, they've done all this work. If things go badly wrong, they can't get gas from Central Asia, the fields go down faster than they think, the new supply doesn't come through as quickly as they think, they will simply ration available supply with European contracts prioritized in the queue. They hope they're not going to have to do that, but if they had to, they would. But I think the trick, Keith, with Central Asia is that they know that whatever the Central Asians do, it's going to take time to create the links to China, to India, through Azerbaijan, to Turkey, if it ever happens. It's going to take time. Now, that's the time that they could use to develop the new supply if they saw that happening. So they're going to get a lot of early warning about Central Asia. And I also think that they have confidence not in the Turkmenbashi, but I think they have more confidence in Kazakhstan delivering, because for Kazakhstan it will be so much more profitable to deliver this gas through Russia than it will be to China. I would say, in terms of a European energy policy, I'm not going to be tempted to give another lecture on this. All I would say is, you know, I'm a veteran, I'm a 30-year veteran of European energy policy. We couldn't even get a European energy policy when we had an EU of 9 members. We got 25 now, going on to 30. I mean, you know, the Green Paper was a sort of valiant attempt to set out a laundry list of all the things that we were concerned about. You know, we're concerned about climate change, we're concerned about competitiveness, we're concerned about security. Yeah, well, sure, but I'm afraid we all know there are trade-offs here. If you're going to have a policy, you've got to say, this is the most important, and this is more important than that, and so we're going to do this rather than that. That's not where we're going. And so I don't have a lot of hope.
Great. Thanks very much. That sounds an awful lot like U.S. energy policy, too. Could, as we start with questions, could I ask you to identify yourself? Ed, did you have one?
Ed Chow. On the top of your Gazprom agenda slide was reform, including sensible things like unbundling. Is there any signs that that's still the number one issue on anyone's agenda in Russia today?
It is not the number one issue, but a large amount of reform has taken place. What is not on anyone's agenda is the breakup of Gazprom. That is absolutely not on anyone's agenda. But they have instituted what in EU speak we call functional unbundling. In other words, instead of having a production association which to produce some gas, transported gas, processed gas, produced condensate, did a lot of other stuff on the side, now all of these functions, they have one function. They're producers, or they're part of Gazprom's oil division, or they're transportation companies, or they're storage companies. That has happened. Now, we have yet to see the transfer prices between these divisions, but they do exist. It's not entirely certain whether people honour them all the time, but they do exist. I think that the model we should look for when we look at Russia is not the US and the UK. It's continental Europe. I mean, what they've looked at, you know, if you speak to Gazprom, you speak to them about reform, they say, well, we're reforming, we're doing the same as Gaz de France is doing. You know, we're doing the same as E.ON Ruhrgas is doing. They haven't got legally separate transportation companies. And that's the model. It's a continental European model of industrial organization. It's not an Anglo-Saxon model.
Jim Dorian. Welcome to Washington, Jonathan.
Thank you very much.
I'm wondering if you're aware of any senior officials within Gazprom that are concerned or have expressed concern about not being able to meet China's needs for gas over the long term. You discounted the West Siberia to China gas pipeline. And in this context, are the ongoing negotiations between the Chinese and the Sakhalin projects considered in your mind as completely separate from the other discussions with respect to West Siberia and East Siberia? In other words, is there any concern that if China does not receive gas or these pipelines from West Siberia or East Siberia to China are not built, will that disrupt negotiations for Sakhalin gas and oil, for that matter?
That's a tough question. I think you should regard oil as really a separate subject. Oil doesn't have the same kind of rules. I mean, the big problem with gas, well, there are several big problems with gas in China. Firstly, that the Chinese have taken a long time to say unambiguously what it is they want. Secondly, this disastrous situation where in 2002 the decree that put Gazprom in charge of all regional gas developments, despite the fact the company had no equity in any of those developments, which set us back a long way. And thirdly, the fact that obviously the people who own those properties want to see their project go ahead first. Now, if we had an unambiguous statement from the Chinese at a high level that they wanted to see 80, 100 more BCM of gas being supplied to China through pipelines by a certain date in the future, I think that would focus minds in Moscow. What I tend to hear in Moscow is, well, you know, it doesn't really matter because the Chinese aren't ready. What you tend to hear from the Chinese is that, well, it doesn't matter because the Russians are still confused and they don't know where the gas is going to come from, so we can't do any proper negotiating with them. So what I was looking for from the meeting in March was an unambiguous statement that, firstly, the projects were going to happen. That I got. What I was hoping to hear further, which I didn't hear, was the Chinese side saying, and we need this line to this place, and incidentally, we, the Chinese, want to take this amount of equity in the upstream. I wanted to hear a really strong statement from them about what they wanted to see happen. And I think that if they made such a statement, whether it be about Kvikta or Sakha or Sakhalin, that would really focus minds in Moscow. My sense is at the moment that there's still a feeling that, well, you know, the Chinese, they're still talking about having to compete with coal, domestic coal, and as long as they're talking about that, they're not really serious, so we don't have to really hurry up our thinking and our organization. What would be very interesting is if the Chinese were to put pressure on Gazprom and say, listen, we want this stuff, now you sort it out. You know, what's coming from Kvikta? What's coming from Sakha? What's coming from Sakhalin? We want to know this. We want to know what's going to be happening in 2015, and we want to see pipe being built. That would really start to put some pressure on. I don't see that pressure at the moment.
In the back. Please.
You know, I mean, I'm getting asked a lot about Gazprom in Latin America, and my response to that, particularly as far as Venezuela, Brazil, Bolivia is concerned, is that this is part of the Gazprom internationalization. This is part of trying to be an ExxonMobil, a BP, a Shell, that, you know, we want to be active in all kinds of other countries where we've never been active before. To which my response is, well, yeah, but doing what? I mean, how does this make any sense? And personally, I can't make any sense of it, but I think it's excellent political capital for Russia in these countries.
I think it's excellent that Gazprom is seen as, quote unquote, involving itself in the development of resources in these countries. People like Chavez clearly think it's a good idea. I'm sure the new Bolivian regime thinks it's a good idea that Gazprom will be a counterweight to the international oil companies. But what does that mean? I mean, I personally don't know what it means or what it could mean. I see it with Miller visiting all these capitals and meeting prime ministers and heads of state oil companies. It's a question of trying to establish diplomatic positions from which something could happen. But I don't think anything very immediate will happen because I don't see Gazprom having that kind of capital reach to put multi-billions of dollars into projects on other continents. And personally, I don't think they should. So it's interesting, but I think it's less immediately exciting than perhaps it seems.
I think it sounds like we need the Monroe Doctrine again. Yes, Julia.
Hi, Jonathan. That was so interesting. I was just wondering if you could comment. Rosneft has quite a bit of gas as well and wants to be a more serious gas player. How do you see the two of them cooperating, or will there be conflicts, especially over Sakhalin?
Uch, yes. This is on the record, isn't it? Yeah, I remember that. Well, let's put it like this. I think that, you know, Julie, you followed the Gazprom-Rosneft merger as like the rest of us, and I think we all saw that the body language between Alexei Miller and Sergei Budyanchukov was, shall we say, not the best we've ever seen between two people who might be coming together in the same company. And therefore, it seems to me that this is one of the really huge problems for Sakhalin. That actually that merger would have been wonderful for Sakhalin. The fact that it didn't happen and the not wonderful relations between the companies in terms of Gazprom being able to buy out Rosneft in those projects is not good for Sakhalin. I don't want to get myself into too much trouble in case I seem to be saying that some of the Sakhalin partners, you know, haven't done as good a job as they might have done in pushing these projects forward. What I think, though, is that there is going to be a time for Sakhalin, and it could be if things go in a particular way, it could be that a lot of the traditional projects will get bypassed and we will see newcomers come into Sakhalin, drill, find a lot of gas and go ahead with development. And I think there's some interesting questions about how quickly a Sakhalin development could move forward if it had the right partners. I thought it was interesting, for example, that there was at least a report of a Chinese company coming together with Rosneft in Sakhalin. If the Chinese get seriously interested in Sakhalin, things could move very quickly. But, of course, that reckons without Gazprom. And the difficulty of doing anything with Russian gas in this region in which Gazprom are not deeply involved, as we know, is highly problematic.
Yes, hi, thanks for your presentation. I'm Christine Tellian. I was just wondering what you can see as the main challenges to the development of Bovinenko. What you think is limiting development right now, if those challenges could be remedied, and over what time period?
Well, I mean, the thing with Bovinenko is that it's probably the most straightforward of the fields. And I'm a sort of close student of the stuff that Venegas publishes on the subject, because I think they've just got the best information. And really, it's now a question of when do they want to put the money in? You know, when do they want to spend the first $20, $25 billion developing Bovinenko? I don't think there's any problem knowing how to do it. It's not that complicated. You know, we know that the pipelines are going to come across the bay now. They're not going to go down. They're not going to go across the peninsula. So it's just a question of how do you see the cost of that versus the prices that you're going to get in the markets in which this is going to be sold. And they have looked at it and they just haven't seen the profitability of it because they are, despite the relationship with the Russian government, they are not convinced that by 2012, 2013, prices in the Russian market are going to be $60 to $80 a thousand in today's dollars. And if you don't see that, I don't think you develop Bovinenko. the question comes, which goes back to what Bob was raising earlier on. Yeah, but how long, just from a total production perspective, can you afford to wait? But I'm not seeing. I mean, just talking to people about what the 2007 investment program is going to contain, I'm not seeing urgency on anyone's part to move forward even in 2007.
That's a very good overview, Jonathan. Appreciate it. The question I had is that Mr. Barroso recently was in Moscow talking with President Putin about a variety of things, and one of the things he brought up was third-party access by the Europeans to the export pipeline. And there's increasingly call for ratification of the Energy Charter Treaty. There was an article, I think, just recently by Anders Osland on this and others. Is this something likely to happen? Is it a panacea? Is it something that would open up the system in a way that would bring in some competition and some alternatives for the Europeans?
I don't think it's likely to happen. If it did happen, then it would create a little more competition. And Mr. Barroso is in a very, very weak position when he goes to Moscow. I mean, he's going to Moscow with the Russians waving the Setra investigation at him to say, hey, 20 years and no one in Europe has done any third-party access worth talking about. You guys are just building bigger dominant positions every day. So Mr. Barroso is not in a good position. I think the key question is the Energy Charter Treaty and the transit protocol that I've been a strong supporter of. But the Russians were let off the hook, frankly, by the EU when the EU raised this wretched Rio clause at such a late stage. Because once the EU did that, we'd been negotiating for a very long time before the EU came forward on that. And it just allowed the conservatives in Moscow to say, you see, these guys aren't really serious about liberalization and access either. They want to keep their markets for themselves. So there's no reason for us to act any differently. I'm relatively pessimistic, but what I think is interesting is, and this is why I part company from Barroso, from Claude Mondil, from the European energy establishment, who keep trying to beat Russia with the third-party access branch. I keep saying, look, stop doing that, because they can turn around and beat us much more effectively than we can beat them. What we need to say to them is, listen, you need more supply. The way you're going to get more supply is to demonstrate to your producers that there are markets out there. Show them that there are markets. Novatek has already said we can produce much more gas if we can see profitable markets. That's the way to do it, not go down this kind of you should adopt European regulation on third-party access. Just say to them, listen, open markets mean more gas, more money, and basically more benefits for everybody. I'm not desperately optimistic about that, though.
It's a timely question. Yes, Len.
Leonard Oberlander, I am wondering, given the implicit assumptions underlying some of this analysis, if you would have some thoughts about the fast pace of events, given that Russia has a state capitalist model with regard to Gazprom, and how a vertical structure that doesn't exist in the West may exist under a state capitalist model where development is based in the regions, and regional governors have great responsibility for drawing in investment and regulating the development, and then the rest, the transportation management, marketing, et cetera, is centrally controlled. Are there implications of this state capitalist model for perhaps supporting vertical integration? And I'm wondering, what are your thoughts about the significance of St. Petersburg as a location where the great facilities are being built now with regard to LNG for the transportation of gas and with the Northern Pipeline, and St. Petersburg being more of a European area than Moscow is, and that the highest court, Supreme Court, is going to be moved to St. Petersburg, which is the ultimate arbiter of the rule of law. What are your thoughts on that?
Excellent questions, but very, very tough to answer. I mean, my sense of this is that the regions, and if you analyze the way that Miller courts the regions, I mean, Miller spends a long time with those regional governors. They come in, he spends, given that, you know, he needs to spend a lot of time talking to international oil companies about major LNG projects, he spends huge amounts of time with regional governments, governors, regional representatives, talking to them about specific gas developments, like, you know, how many kindergartens and how many apartment blocks in their area. And I mean, it's very noticeable how important Petersburg is in this. So it's hard to give you a convincing answer. All I would say is I think you've identified a situation which shows up the tensions between the centralized model and the fact that when the regions come in to plead their case, usually because, you know, they haven't paid their debts or they want Gazprom to invest in some clearly, totally uneconomic piece of infrastructure, they get a very nice hearing. Doesn't matter that maybe it doesn't happen, but they're not kind of brusquely dismissed and told, we haven't got time for you. So Miller, and he must be taking this from Putin, he's very careful about how he treats the regions, and he travels extensively to the regions and talks to them about what they're concerned about. And of course, he has to keep his Siberian guys on side, and you know, all of that is yet another political situation he has to manage.
I think we have time for two quick questions or one slow question. Which Jeff?
About 1 year ago, Gazprom was promoting, talking about an economic development program, that is development of the Russian Far East and East Siberia, and indicated that domestic gas resources should be used first and foremost to promote this economic development. And in fact, I believe the Kavitka line would first send 4 or 5 BCM to Yakutsk area. Has Gazprom dropped this idea entirely, or is this just on the back shelves?
No, but this feeds in very nicely from the last question. You know, this is regional development stuff which they don't just pay lip service to. I mean, they know perfectly well that economically a regional development program in the Russian Far East is about the most disastrous thing you could possibly invest in, just because of the parlous economic situation of that whole set of regions. But they are also extremely sensitive to the fact that if they allow this region simply to be seen as an export region for Asia, they're going to store up massive discontent among those few remaining souls who still live in these regions. So I think they have decided that this has to be a big subsidy element program. They're not moving ahead with it very quickly, but they're certainly making a big noise about, for example, the Kvitka domestic gas. And also, they keep talking about Krasnoyarsk, all sorts of Kamchatka, all sorts of places where you think, why on earth would you spend any money on a development program out there? Well, the answer is that if you don't, you're going to get kind of local uprisings on a grand scale. That something has to be given to these guys, and that's really these are not, if you like, headline news points. But it's surprising, if you look at the internal Gazprom press, how much time is spent on them.
One last question from Keith.
Well, go back to the foreign investment thing, and I take your point about the continental Europe model versus the Anglo-Saxon model of how they're looking at foreign investors. The new minerals law, which limits foreign investment to 49%, There's talk that really Gazprom, or within the Kremlin, Kremlin administration, the real figure on, and the new figure on the limits of foreign investment in a Russian company in that area is 20%. As the pressures may develop, in fact, companies may not want to buy unless they have some reciprocity. And Gazprom is going all over the place. I've been kind of put together some figures from around Europe and either even Algeria now, where they're trying to buy some Algerian gas to ship to the United States. At some point, do you think there'll be pressure to raise that, the real 20% level, to the point where people will have a blocking minority, or at least a greater say in some of the Russian companies as they go onto the stock markets?
I greatly doubt it.
You doubt it.
I greatly doubt it. And I mean, the only thing that would make me change my mind is, you know, if we were suddenly looking at $20 oil rather than $60 oil. I mean, the self-confidence in Russia today is really that, you know, if we need these guys, we can buy their services anytime we like. We got people queuing up outside our offices wanting to do stuff with us. We can pick and choose the people we want. I'm not saying that's the right perception. I'm saying that is the perception they have. Everyone is desperate to do things with Gazprom, and indeed with anything to do with Russia. So I wouldn't be confident that they would want to give higher percentages than 20, or indeed anything that they need to give away. Their situation at the moment is probably, you know, in their dreams they couldn't have imagined being in the situation they're in today. And until something changes with that, which is really oil prices, it's hard to see how that perception is going to change.
Before thanking Jonathan, I just wanted to offer, for those of you who were a little bit uncertain as to the reference to body language, if you need further elaboration, there are people in this room who have been through corporate acquisitions who clearly understand body language. So let me just take a minute and thank you all for coming. Thank Lisa and Sonia for everything they did to make it happen, and particularly to thank Jonathan for a brilliant and in-depth and convincing explanation and prediction regarding gas, Gazprom, and the Russian role in the gas market. Jonathan, thanks very much, and come back anytime.
Thanks a lot.